22, Revelation chapter 22. And we left off, it was a couple weeks ago, but at verses 6 and 7, where we were reading at that time. And we want to read that again as we start tonight. And Brother Dave, could you read Revelation 22, verses 6 and 7 for us?
And he said unto me, these things are faithful and true, and the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show unto his servants the things which must shortly be done. Behold, I come quickly. Blessed is he that keepeth the sayings of this prophecy of this book.
All right. In verse 7 there, or verse 6, he mentions the certainty of the things that he has spoken. These sayings are faithful and true. Well, why is that statement found right there? What is it in the context that makes that important, that gives that very deep meaning? Well, what's the context here? He says these sayings. What has he been saying? Well, let's remember verse 1 here of this chapter began with the word "and he showed me." So continuing from what was in chapter 21, who is the he? Well, that's the angel of the Lord that carried John away in the spirit to that great high mountain to show him the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Going back to chapter 21, verses 9 and 10. So that's when that particular angel began to show, gave that vision to John. It's reported in the rest of chapter 21, that vision of heaven, of the city four square, and who enters into it. And then we have the chapter break, but the subject does not change. And so continuing right on in here into chapter 22, the angel is showing John that pure river of water of life that's clear as crystal that proceeds out of the throne of God and the Lamb. Then there's the tree of life and bearing its fruits there in verse 2. And there's no more curse. The throne of God and the Lamb is in that place, and his servants will serve him there. They will see his face. His name will be in their foreheads. In verse 4, there'll be no night there. Verse 5, no need of candle, nor light of the sun. The Lord God gives the light, and they will reign forever and ever. So we've had now for over a chapter all of this describe of our heavenly home and how magnificent it is. Well, having reached the end of that description of heaven here, the Lord punctuates it with this statement that his sayings are faithful and true. So what does that tell us about this place of heaven that he says is available for his servants to serve him there for all eternity and to reign with his son Jesus Christ?
That's a fact.
It's a fact. That's exactly right. So he's underscoring the certainty of God keeping his promise. So is there any room for doubt in our minds if we fulfill the will of God? Now, this is not an unconditional promise here. The promise of heaven is not an unconditional one. Otherwise, we would have universal salvation, correct? If heaven is literally for everybody, if it's promised to all and going to be fulfilled for all, it is available to all. It's the offering for that place, and that's something that we've seen a number of times, and he's going to close the book with that. He's going to speak in verse 18 of this chapter, testifying to every man who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If any man adds to it, well, that's after he's mentioned in verse 17, when the Spirit and the Bride say, "Come," let him that hears say, "Come," and let him that is athirst come, and whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely. So who whosoever will. That's who this is offered to. So this promise is made available to everyone, but is it going to be fulfilled upon everyone? No, again, because otherwise we would have universal salvation, and we do not. Do the scriptures say that everybody's going to go to heaven? Now, people tend to think that way. I mean, how many people, just your average person, believes in heaven and thinks that they and pretty much everybody they know and everybody in their family is going to go there? So if you actually, if you went by what people think, then you're pretty close to universal salvation, right? But is it going to be based on what we think or what we feel? It's not going to be based on that. It's going to be based on God's judgment according to, well, he told us, didn't he, at the end of chapter 20. It's going to be according to, we're all going to be judged, every man, according to his works, what we've done in this life, based on the standard when he opens those books in the book of life, whether our name is written there, which is going to be based upon whether or not we have obeyed his gospel and then done the things to keep our name there, that is, keeping his commandments, which is where he goes in verse 7 to, again, remind us of that condition. We have to keep the commandments of the Lord. We have to do his will. Jesus said that in Matthew 21, verse 7, not everyone that saith unto me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but whom? That's right. And that's very plain, isn't it? Whoever does the will of the Father, which means if we don't do the will of the Father, we're not going to be there. Are there going to be many that are going to say, Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in your name, or preach in your name, or teach in your name? Didn't we do these many wonderful works in your name? Didn't we do all this for Jesus? I mean, how many people are doing things and saying they're doing this for Jesus? They love the Lord and they're doing this for Jesus. Is that all it means? All it takes is to claim, to do whatever and claim it's for Jesus and then you're home free? That's not it. It's got to be according to the will of the Father. And how many people are doing things that they claim are in the name of Christ, but in fact are wrong? That's why Jesus said, depart from me, you workers of iniquity, I never knew you. That's what he's going to say to those men. So we have to be very careful and make sure we're not among the many that are thinking that, well, we're doing what we're doing for the Lord, but not being certain according to what he's taught in his word that we are. So, but can we know? Yes, we can. And how do we know that we know him? Remember 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 and verses 7 through 9 says that Jesus is going to come back in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and not obey the gospel. So those who don't know God are going to be among the ones that he said will be partaking of that eternal destruction from the presence of the Lord. That's the way he phrases it in 2 Thessalonians 1. Well, those who do not know God will be separated from God for eternity. So we have to know God to go to heaven. I mean, that's one of the things that he says. Alright, well, can we know that we know him?
Yes.
How do we know that we know him? According to 1 John chapter 2 and verses 3 and 4. If we say that we know him and don't keep his commandments, we are what?
Liars.
But hereby we know that we know him if we keep his commandments, he says. So we can know him and we can know that we know him. But that comes by keeping his commandments. Well, can we know his commandments? Can we know, well, the Lord said to do this and the Lord said don't do that. The Lord taught this. Can we know that? We certainly can. That's what we're trying to do right now. But if we step away from his word and we're going by our own thoughts or the wisdom of men, our feelings or anything else other than what God said, then we are not on safe ground at all. So here's the reminder in these two verses in Revelation 22, verses 6 and 7, that God's part, what he has promised, he is certain to fulfill. So is there room for doubt or question in our mind if we have kept his commandments, whether or not God's going to fulfill? fulfill what he's promised to give us this place or our eternal home. There's no room to doubt him at all. But we do have to meet his conditions. So he reminds us there of the certainty of his promises when he says these things are faithful and true. So it's good that we are reminded of that, so that we can be confident in what he has said, that that when we have done the will of God, that we are going to have heaven for our eternal home, that we will get to see his face and be with him forever. So we don't have to we have no room for doubting on any of that. So then the next thing that he states there, and the Lord God of the holy prophets sent his angel to show to his servants the things which must shortly be done. So must be. And so this is something that that must be done, that what he's talking about here, that this day of judgment that goes back to chapters 19 and 20 that he was describing there, and then following the judgment where we will be given heaven for our eternal home if we kept his commandments. So that must be shortly done. All right, now that's certainly from God's perspective, and we are reminded from those words and also what we see in verse 7, behold, I come quickly. Soon is what that means. And from God's perspective, whenever that is. And do we know the day or the hour?
No one knows.
Only the Father knows the day or the hour. What about undertaking the effort to try to figure out from what's going on in the world and try to read those things and see if we can tell whether it's getting near the end of the world or Christ coming? That's right, Bill Lawrence.
Just need to be ready.
What's that?
We just need to be ready.
We just need to be ready, and that's exactly correct. I mean, that's the point of Matthew 24 and Luke 17, Luke 21, Mark 13, all those passages that deal exactly with that subject in detail, where he makes the contrast between, for example, when the destruction of Jerusalem is going to occur, which happened in 70 A.D., when the Roman armies came and surrounded it, and he told them that would be the sign when the armies surrounded Jerusalem, and then the abomination of desolation, when you had the Gentile would go in and make an offering in God's temple, which Titus, the Roman general, and later to be emperor, and by the way, there's a huge arch in Jerusalem, right across the street from the Colosseum. I don't know if you've ever been to Rome, but I got to see that a number of years ago when my firstborn over there was in a little stroller. She was there too. She just doesn't remember it. But anyway, that's Titus's arch, and the whole thing on there, it's commemorating the victory in Jerusalem. And that arch still stands today. It's a magnificent sight. But that's what all that's about. But Titus is the one that brought the armies there. He's the one that destroyed the city. He's the one that went in and made that offering on the altar of the temple. Well, all of that was given by Christ as a sign for Christians who were in Jerusalem to flee and not to go collect anything at home. But when that happened, get out. And they did. The disciples were spared from the destruction that came at that time because of heeding the warning. But he said, of that day and that hour of his coming again, no man knows. So we can't read the events and try to figure it out. And as what Lawrence says, that what he said, and how he concludes all that is, we need to be ready. We need to watch and be ready at all times, doing his will. Because again, here in Revelation 22, we have a reminder that our time here on this earth is short. And Christ is going to return. And it will be soon. our task is to be ready, and how do we have ourselves prepared? Well, that's where he goes next. Behold, I come quickly. Blessed is he that heareth the sayings of the prophecy of this book. All right? And so we need to... Now, is it just, okay, I've heard the words, and I'm going to go along and do what I want? That's not kind of hearing he's talking about, obviously. And we mentioned this is the sixth blessing that's in the book of Revelation. Very similar to the first one. It was in chapter 1, verse 3. If we can go back there and read that one. Let's see, Brother Glenn, can you read Revelation 1, verse 3 for us?
Blessed is he that readeth, and they that hear the words of this prophecy, and keep those things which are written therein, for the time is at hand.
All right, so very similar, isn't it? In fact, what we're going to see in verse 14 here, chapter 22, is going to add that other part in with another seventh and final of the blessings. Blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life, and may enter in through the gates into the city. So that connection between hearing the words and doing them. Well, that's been an emphasis in the New Testament all the way through. How did Jesus conclude the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, how many sermons can match that one? Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. We have three lengthy chapters in the Gospel of Matthew recording a sizable portion of that sermon that we learn so much from. I mean, that sermon is rich in its teachings. So much of what is what Christ is about in the New Testament. There's so much of that that's brought out in that sermon. Well, how did it conclude? In fact, we have another sermon that Jesus taught that we have so much detail recorded. In the other sermon, we have three lengthy chapters just of his words. We don't have another one like that. I think the only other sermon that we have preserved in that many words, it's not even that many. Well, the next closest that comes to my mind would be in Acts 7, the Stephen's sermon. We have quite a bit of that one. The portion of Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost is much smaller than that. But we have a lot of the Sermon on the Mount. How do we finish it? With that song that all our children know. The wise man built his house upon a rock. And where did the foolish man build his house? It's on the sand. Well, what is all that? What is it about building houses? What was the point about that? Who is the wise man who built his house upon the rock? Yes, and the foolish one is the one who hears but doesn't do. So the actual hearing of the words is the given part there. The difference lies within whether we just hear the words and don't do them, or whether we hear the words and do them. Very similarly. When they came to Jesus and told him when he was in a crowded house and the crowds were so thick people couldn't pass through, and his mother and brothers were looking to see him. This is in Matthew chapter 12. And Jesus made a point about who he identifies as his family. And it's the same thing. In Matthew chapter 12, they came to him in verse 47 and said that his mother and brothers were outside desiring to speak with him. And he answered and said to them, who is my mother and who are my brethren? And he stretched forth his hand toward his disciples and said, behold my mother and my brethren. For whosoever shall do the will of my Father which is in heaven, the same as my brother and sister and mother. To be his family, we have to hear his word and do it. I mean, where's room in any of this for someone to just hear his word and not do what he says? Or say, well, I believe on him, and then not do what he says? The emphasis is always placed on hearing the words and then doing the things that he's taught. What did he say in John 14, 15? If you love me, keep his commandments. So we have to, that's what is required of the Lord. Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 9, Jesus Christ has become the author of eternal salvation unto all men that what? Obey Him. I mean, when you look at all those scriptures, and we've run through quite a few of them just in a little bit here, in Matthew 7:21, and a little bit further down in Matthew 7 with the conclusion of the Sermon on the Mount, with the wise man versus the foolish man, to Matthew 12, and who his brethren are, and Hebrews 5:9, what we're seeing here in Revelation. Just running through those few, we could go a whole lot more, and I'd be happy to do it if we need more. And of course, over time, we want to catch them all. But anyway, we see so many scriptures that tell us we have to keep His commandments. We have to obey Him in order for us to receive these blessings that He's promised. So here the blessing is on hearing the words of the prophecy. And then it's connected with the doing of it, as we saw in chapter 1, verse 3 of Revelation. And then we see it also brought out in verse 14 and many other places. So we're going to be judged according to our words, whether we've obeyed Him or not. But if we hear these things, and we just study through and all that He's spoken about our heavenly home, is that a blessing to hear those words? I mean, how much of our hope is in that? Based on the resurrection of the dead, which is based on the resurrection of Christ, but in this place that He's telling us about here. But we have to keep His commandments to do it. So reading that, I mean, does that give us any encouragement, any motivation to do the will of God? Knowing that if we do that, this is where we spend our eternity. Not just a little time, but all of our eternity, forever and ever, without end. That should be a strong motivator and encourager to all of us. Alright, well, moving on further here in Revelation 22, verse 8. Let's read that. Let's see, Brother Lawrence, can you read that? Revelation 22:8.
And I, John, saw these things and heard them. And when I had heard and seen, I fell down to worship before the feet of the angel, which showed me these things.
Now, just like we saw the similarity in verse 7 with what we saw in chapter 1, verse 3, a lot of these things, the conclusion of Revelation circles back to things that he started the book with. And so we saw that right there from verse 7. We see it also in verse 8. I mean, there's a lot of similarity with what he says, the emphasis on the fact that John was recording what he saw and heard there with the very beginning of the book of Revelation. I mean, the book begins with the statement that this is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass. All right, we saw that statement nearly repeated verbatim there in verses 5 and 6 in chapter 22. Verse 2 then, after saying at the end of verse 1 that he was signified by his angel to his servant John, who bare record of the word of God, and of the testimony of Jesus Christ, and of all things that he saw. So that's the point made there, that John was going to be the one by whom the Father was going to make known this revelation of the Son through an angel to John the Apostle. But John was going to be writing down what he saw. And we've seen that throughout the book, but he's emphasizing it again here. Now we're getting near the end. And I, John, saw these things and heard them. So it's more of the giving us the certainty of what's written. This is not somebody's imagination. This isn't guesswork. This is God's revelation. He showed this to John, and John heard the words. He saw these things and heard the words, and so he's written down exactly what God showed him. So we know that this is not man's imagination. Now, there are plenty of things where men will write in books or paint things with their imagination of what they think heaven is going to be and reading that. That's not what this is. This is real. This is exactly what the place is like. This is exactly who's going to be there. This is given by God Himself, telling His servants, here's where I am, and here's where you will get to spend your eternity with me, seeing my face, and being here in this place. And so it's through John that he's shown that, but then John is again reminding us that he saw these things and heard them. Now, when he did so, and this is the second time this has happened, what's his reaction when he's just been given that vision of heaven that started there in chapter 21 and just ends there? How does he respond to that? With this angel that showed him all of that. Yeah. I mean, is it fair to say that he was stunned and overwhelmed with what he saw? I mean, what if we had been reading is awesome. What if you'd actually seen that vision? That's mind-blowing to even try to conceive that, really, but that's just because, from our vantage point, we might think, well, how could John, being an apostle of Christ, be that dumb to fall down to start to worship an angel? Well, what did he just see? I mean, this is a response to what he just was shown, that we've just been reading about. I mean, it really is a testimony to the awesomeness of the vision that he was just given. His response is to fall down and to worship the one who's shown him all of this. Now, obviously, John is mindful of God. This is the word of God. But the fact is that God did use an angel to reveal it, and therefore John should not worship the angel. And that's what he's told there in verse 8. Well, this happened before. You might remember what this happened before. It was in chapter 19. Right after he was given the vision of the marriage supper of the Lamb. So it's happened twice in the book, but there is an understandable element to that. So he's shown the marriage supper of the Lamb, where his bride is presented in that pure white linen. And that was his response to that. And then he's shown this vision of the city four square, heaven itself, and all of its glory. And on both times, his response is falling down to worship there at the feet of the angel. But both times, there in chapter 19, and then again here in chapter 22 and verse 8, the first time was in Revelation 19 and verse 10, and he was told not to do that. What was he? Let's go back to Revelation 19 just to read that, see that. Similarity here, Revelation chapter 19, verse 10, with Michael.
And I fell at his feet to worship him, and he said unto me, See thou, do it not, I am thy fellow servant, and of thy brethren, and have the testimony of Jesus. Worship God, for the testimony of Jesus is the spirit of prophecy.
All right, so he was told not to do that, and was told why, and was told, rather, who he should worship, which is excellent teaching for everybody. Well, should we worship angels?
No.
But how great are angels? I mean, they are magnificent beings. But aren't they?
But it's a good check to see whether it's a real angel or not.
Well,
if they accept your worship, you may want to enjoy the rest of it.
Yeah, of course, you do have that problem of having offered worship. But at any rate, yes, obviously a faithful, a true and faithful angel of God would have received that from anybody. Which is interesting because this is, I know, a bit of a sidetrack. But when you read in Joshua chapter 5, right before Joshua went into Jericho, the captain of the Lord's host appeared to Joshua there, and he fell down and worshipped. And he was told, that being said, don't worship me. Or did he say, take off your shoes, this is holy ground? Very different response. So he was not. So was that an angel that appeared to Joshua there? Could we deduce that that being was more than an angel just based on the response? Yes, there was some, that was not just an angel, because we would see the same response, wouldn't we? I mean, the angels in the Old Testament, they were still angels. The statement about them, the description of them that the angel gives in chapter 19 is still true. It was true then, it's true now. Now, I mean, are angels, are they magnificent and glorious beings and faithful in their service to God and heaven? I mean, just think of how long have those angels been doing their work and serving God faithfully? I mean, throughout, I mean, the history of this world, at least. And they continue to do that. And so that's not diminishing the importance of angels, but they still are. Well, what are their origins? Hebrews 1 and verse 7. What are the origins? And that's a quotation from the Psalms, in fact. But what does Hebrews 1 and verse 7 say? And the point of it, why does he bring up angels and their origin in chapter 1 of Hebrews? As a contrast to Christ. Christ is not an angel. He says, to which of the angels said he at any time, thou art my beloved son, thou art my son, this day hath begotten me. Quoting from Psalm 2. Then he goes on in verse 7 to say, he maketh his angels spirits. Well, that's different. Angels are created beings, aren't they? There's a contrast between Christ and the angels. That's the real point of Hebrews chapter 1. Which, by the way, that's the next chapter that we're planning to study in here after Revelation. So that's a little bit of a preview there. But anyway, that quotation from the Psalm that he gives in Hebrews 1 reminds us angels are created beings. So from that standpoint, well, we've been created also. Now we are in flesh, and angels are not fleshly beings, they're spirit beings, but they're still created of God, and from that standpoint, we are fellow servants of God. We're created beings serving the same Creator. So is there any part of the creation that is worthy of worship? No, including angels. Which obviously includes any man. So man is not to be worshipped. What did Cornelius do in Acts 10 when he heard the gospel preached by the Apostle Peter? He had a similar response. But Peter told him not to do that because Peter was a man. So men, angels, the created being, the part of the creation, we are not to receive worship. What about praying to saints? Well, now, of course, if we understand the Bible and what saint, what does that word mean in the Bible? It means holy ones. And you can look at the scriptures that of Christians, and I think we've probably done this before, but it won't hurt us to do it again. This might remind us of being back in school. You remember back in school when we learned about sex and things like that? Well, there's some prominent religious denominations among the large so-called Christian denominations that have a view of Christians subset within Christianity where you have saints. That's a subclass or a supergroup of Christians. There are only certain ones that could achieve sainthood. That's not what the Bible teaches. To go by the scriptural teaching, we have Christians and saints. They're the same. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Hebrews 12:14. Well, saints are holy ones. So according to that, if you're one of these Christians that's not a holy one, according to Hebrews 12, verse 14, what does that mean? You're not going to see him. So it better be true for all our sakes that Christians and holy ones, that they're one and the same. And that's what the scriptures teach. So there are, though, those ones that have that view of that special class of saints, that they'll pray to saints, so-called. And that's a form of worship, isn't it? I mean, prayer, that's to be offered to God. To God only, that's an act of worship. And so to pray to another human being, what did Daniel do when that was made a law in Daniel 6, in Daniel chapter 6, when they made that law that nobody could pray to God for 30 days. They could only go directly to their Darius. Daniel wouldn't do it. He continued to pray to God. There was only one being he was going to pray to. And because God is the only being that's worthy of worship. And so we can't pray to so-called saints. What about Mary, the mother of Christ? And there's that, and we know it's Roman Catholics venerate Mary and put her on a pedestal of really a deity. We don't find any authority for that in the New Testament at all. In fact, we find these teachers, like what we're looking at right here, that are against that. So angels, people, you know, we don't pray to worship in any form, any part of the creation, at any time. That's not acceptable. Who we worship, it's actually very simple as far as the commandment. What did that angel say in chapter 19, verse 10? Worship God. Is there anything more to it than that? That's the right one. That's the right being to worship. And so when John fell down here, well, what does the angel say to him in verse 9? Let's go ahead and did we just read verse 8 or did we read 9 too, Michael? Brother Ted, can you read verse 9? Revelation 22.
Then said he unto me, see, the dog is not, for I am thy fellow servant and of thy chief brother, the prophet, and of them that keep the saying of this book, which is God.
All right, how similar is the response in verse 9 here to what we saw in Revelation 19, verse 10? I mean, it's virtually identical, isn't it? Again, he's told to worship God. So that's an excellent reminder to everybody that no matter what the circumstance is, we always must worship God and we must only worship God. That is, when we offer worship, it must only be to God. So we have those designated times that we come together and worship, and we're worship God. Subject to our worship. So the one who has made all these things, the one who has promised all these things and will fulfill all these things, and the one who's spoken all these things, that's God. And he's the one that is worthy of our worship. So even though these angels are magnificent beings, powerful beings, they're still made by God. And where do they get their authority? From God. I mean, these angels that are showing John these things in this book, they're sent. And we see that over and over again. They were sent to reveal these things. In fact, what does the word angel mean? Messenger. It's the same meaning in Hebrew and in Greek for those beings. But it's a messenger. That tells you that they're not doing anything on their own. we read about some angels who sin in 2 Peter chapter 2 and then the book of Jude, which recounts the same event. But there's some information given about angels who left their first estate. Well, we don't know exactly where God told them to be and for how long, and we're not given all the details there, but we are given information that they left whatever that was. God had sent them to a place, and they left the place. They did something they weren't authorized to do. They left the place where God designated that they would be. And so then they were to be subject to God's punishment for breaking his commandment. What does that tell you about all the other angels? I mean, how many, think of that record that they have of their service to God, their faithfulness. I mean, the ones that sinned, there's that one occasion where they were told to go somewhere and then they left that place, and then they've been reserved in chains of darkness for to be punished by the Lord for eternity. So all the other angels, that means every time they're sent to do something, they're faithfully doing that without exception. I mean, that's just, it's magnificent to think about how faithful those beings are in serving God. But they're not worthy of our worship. They were used by God throughout this book of Revelation. We've read about so many of them that God sent to show John things, but they were only saying to John and showing John things that God directed them to. So they weren't doing any of that on their own. So there's a reminder of that there through verse 9 here in Revelation chapter 22. If we turn over to Colossians chapter 2, verse 18, we see something along the same lines as the subject before we move on. But Colossians chapter 2, let's read there verse 18 for the day.
Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and worshiping of angels, intruding into those things which he hath not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind.
All right, well, he mentions worshiping of angels there, and what would be the consequence of that, which would go along with offering worship to any being or any creature or anything else other than God? I mean, does it have to be specifically angels, or would this also apply to anything else that's not God? But what's the cost of that if we do it?
Lose your soul.
Yeah, we can be beguiled of our reward. Well, what are we reading about here in Revelation chapter 21 and 22? The eternal reward. So if we go off and worship angels or any other part of the creation, if we're not serving God and keeping his commandments, then we will be beguiled of this reward. There's yet another passage that shows us the conditions that God has set. These are not unconditional promises he's given. We have to do his will. And that includes that he is the sole recipient of our worship. All right? So back to Revelation chapter 22. Let's read verses 10 and 11. Revelation 22, 10 and 11, Brother Glenn.
And he saith unto me, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. And he which is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still.
All right, well, we have a few things to work our way through in those two verses. The time is at hand. Well, again, our time on this earth is short. The subject of man's salvation, is that an urgent matter? Verses certainly demonstrate that, doesn't it? I mean, it's not something that is to be taken lightly. lightly or to be viewed like, ah, there's plenty of time for that. I mean, how many people have thought there was plenty of time for whatever when there wasn't? How many of us in here have more time than we know what to do with? If that's an issue, we need to talk, because that's a problem. And it's not a problem of there being too much time. I mean, I don't think any of us in here would have that problem. I think we all recognize it. The hard part is doing all the things that we can see the need to do and serving God in the limited amount of time that we have. That's the most difficult part. But at any rate, there's still a very short time that we're here on this earth, and to prepare ourselves, you know, going back to what Brother Lawrence was reminding us, that's what we have to do. We don't know when the end's going to come, so the only thing we can do is prepare ourselves and be ready at all times. So there's no room there for us to be slack about the time and of the matter of our preparation for eternity. So he said, seal not the sayings of the prophecy of this book, for the time is at hand. All right, let's turn over to Romans chapter 13. And let's read here verse 11. And this is something he reminds us of. Romans 13:11. Let's see, Brother Lawrence, you got that?
When I was a child, I spake.
That was 1 Corinthians 13:11, wasn't it?
I was right.
They were chapter verse. On in from there. That doesn't carry that idea with it at all. What's he tell us to do? Wake up. So we can't afford to go to sleep spiritually. He says, for now our salvation is nearer than when we believed. We don't know how much time we have, but we got less than we did. We know that, don't we? That time we were looking for, we knew that we needed to start preparing for our eternity and do what the Lord says to do. Well, we've got less time now than we had at that point, whenever that was. And every day that goes by, it's that much less. We don't know how much there's going to be, but we know we got less, and it's getting closer. Our time of reaching eternity, it's getting closer. That's true of every one of us. We don't want to forget that, because that's key to our being prepared and ready. All right, let's see a similar thought conveyed in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 2. Brother Michael, 2 Corinthians 6. Actually, 1 and 2. Go ahead, read verses 1 and 2 here.
We then, as workers together with him, beseech you also that you receive not the grace of God in vain, for he said, I have heard thee in the time accepted, and the day of salvation has heard thee. Behold, now is the accepted time. Behold, now is the day of salvation.
All right. So, again, is this written to unbelievers or believers? Yeah. So he's, just like we saw in Colossians 2 a while ago, we don't want to let anybody be man but God is of our reward, and as we mentioned on Romans 13, verse 11, spiritually go to sleep. Well, here he's telling us not to receive the grace of God in vain. Well, is it possible to receive the grace of God in vain? All right, how many verses do we need to refute the false doctrine of once saved, always saved? That's the doctrine that says once you are saved and receive the grace of God, that you can never be eternally lost in. That's what he means. How many do we need to refute that?
One.
And how many do we have? I never counted them, but if this one right here does it, doesn't it? When he says he's beseeching us not to receive the grace of God in vain, how can that verse have any meaning whatsoever if it were impossible to receive the grace of God in vain? I mean, that verse would lose all meaning. I know that's kind of a side point to it, but it really kind of screams at you, doesn't it? I mean, it's very, very apparent from just the wording there. We can receive the grace of God in vain. Well, I mean, just what we just saw a moment ago in Colossians 2:18, let no man beguile your reward. Well, can we? I mean, what meaning does that verse have if you can't? And then Romans 13:11, what meaning does that verse have when he says to awake and for us to remember that our salvation is nearer than when we first believed? I mean, all those verses are reason we're looking at them all right now, because it goes along with what we're seeing at this point in Revelation 22, the urgency of the matter, that we have to prepare, that we need to get ready, and that even though we might be, if we're not a Christian, we better become one, and have our name written in the book of life. This is another way of dealing with the point of keeping our name written there, not having it blotted out. Well, I mean, what's the difference between receiving the grace of God in vain or letting someone beguile us of our reward and end up having our name blotted out of the book of life? I mean, that's the same thing. But this deals with some of the ways that can happen. Not to receive the grace of God in vain, and reminds us that God has said that he has heard us in a time accepted, and in the day of salvation he has suffered us. So he's helped us then. And so, behold, when is the acceptable? When is the day of salvation?
Now.
That's the word he used. What's that?
Hebrews, he uses that.
Yeah, I was about to say Hebrews 13.
He said it's not a certain day to enter his rest. He called it today.
He called it today. Quoting from Psalm 95, which he's quoting there in Hebrews 3 and then on into chapter 4. But he repeatedly emphasizes that word today. Today you will hear his voice, harden not your hearts. As in the day of provocation in the wilderness. Today, and it goes back to that, and he said it, repeats it several times. And it's always going to be today, isn't it?
It's the only day.
Yeah, it is. Because I remember my kids get confused on that sometimes, because they, you know, talk about doing something tomorrow, Lord willing. Well, but many of you tell them, well, it's still today. Today is today, it's not tomorrow. But anyway, at a certain point, we kind of wrap our brains around that a little bit. But it is always today. So it's always, today is the time we have. This now is the time we have. This is the time we have to deal with. We have no promise of anything more. So when do we need to use the time and redeem it and be wise and prepare ourselves and be ready? We need to make sure we're ready right now, this day, this moment. And then perpetually be in that state of readiness. Isn't that the point? So we can't ever step back from our diligence in keeping the commandments of God. Well, we have a reminder there in Matthew 24. At that moment when that servant says, oh, the Lord delays his coming, and then we stop doing the Lord's will and start doing other things, what is it? So that's when the Lord will come, and then what happens? Then you get your appointed your portion with the hypocrites. So we have all those warnings there, and we need to heed them and prepare ourselves and be ready and be doing that at all times. Never, never slack up, go to sleep spiritually, or forsake the Lord. let anybody, regardless of our reward, receive the grace of God in vain, or any of those things. All right, we'll go ahead and stop there.